This is the JN Podcast. I'm Phil Dave, and coming up on this show, presenter and campaigner Rachel Riley will be talking about the removal of conspiracy theorist David Icke from YouTube. We'll hear firsthand from Maurice Bennett, CBE, about his recollections of VE Day. Our coronavirus hero will be 11-year-old Alex Kortz as he tells us how he is using a 3D printer to help fight against COVID-19. And our business thought will come from Mark Knorr, Group CEO of Miramar Agencies, a collective of marketing and advertising agencies. But before all of that, welcome along to this episode of the JN Podcast. Joining me to go through the paper review, as we normally start off each show, is Justin Cohen, news editor for the Jewish News, and features editor Fran Wolfish. Welcome to both of you.
Hi, Phil.
Hi, Phil.
Now, let's have a look. First and foremost, the front page, Justin, is where we normally start. And we have the death of the youngest known Jewish victim to coronavirus making the front page this week.
Yes, a very sad story, unfortunately, to lead the paper this week. The death of YY Rothschild. His full name was Yechiel Yosef, but he was known by all his friends as YY. And a man that was just 20 years old seemed to have made an amazing impact in his few short years. Someone that people speak about brightening up the room, being the life and soul of the party. Someone who was extremely kind in his approach to life. Just a few days before he himself was ill, he was inquiring about some of those who supported him, who had been unwell themselves, and how they were doing. YY had Down syndrome, and he really was impacted by a lot of fantastic charities across the community, from Side by Side to Kisharon. But there's one particular organization, Shabbaton Lemenucha, that has decided that such was his impact that they wanted to do something in his memory. And so they've started a fundraising campaign to buy a Torah in his memory. Wow. And they've already raised £54,000 in very quick succession.
Wow.
So they're hoping just for another £6,000 and they'll be able to purchase this amazing tribute to YY.
Oh, well, here's hoping they do. And that's fantastic. And you know what? Obviously, it's incredibly sad and just, Fran, a painful reminder that, of course, that this is a very real situation we find ourselves in. But what a lovely way to hopefully honour his memory.
Absolutely. And the other thing I really want to sort of emphasise as well, and we all know this, but this really brings it home, doesn't it? That it's not just old people. It's not just the over 70s who are dying from this terrible virus. We have young victims as well, and we have young victims from our community. So I think as well that it's a reminder to us all why we're doing what we're doing at the moment. And this is a lovely thing to do in his memory as well. Very, very sad that a young man should lose his life in this way.
Certainly is. That's on the front page, and it's also covered on page 8 of the Jewish News for this week. Let's have a look at a story coming out of Israel, where they have potentially made a bit of a breakthrough for coronavirus treatment, hopefully.
That's right, Phil. I don't know what you were doing on Monday evening of this week, but I have to say I was on social media getting rather excitable when this news came through. Naftali Bennett paid a secret visit to Israel's military lab, where he was able to be briefed on what is hoped to be a life-saving antibodies treatment that Israel has discovered. Now, before anyone gets too excited, of course, other countries also, Holland in particular, also claim to have come up with potentially an antibody treatment. And it's not yet clear whether the Israeli version has yet been treated on either animals or on humans. But we all wish them the best. And I think it's a sign of everyone's absolute will and hope that this comes to fruition, the excitement that it caused on social media. And, you know, just thinking ahead about what it would mean if Israel was the country to heal the world.
It would be a lovely thought, and here's hoping that they are successful in that. That's on page 2 of this week's paper. VE Day. Now, this is obviously something we're marking on the 8th of May, hopefully as a country in some weird way. We will also be doing it ourselves on this podcast. I say weird way for obvious reasons. Of course, it's a wonderful thing to mark. And Fran, you've been marking it in the paper this week.
We have. Just before we get into that, actually, I think it's worth saying that this is the third sort of big event that I can sort of think of that we've had to sort of mark while at home with our families. You know, first there was Yom HaShoah, and they did a fabulous job with that that live-streamed ceremony. Then there was, of course, Yom Ha'atzmaut. I, for one, enjoyed a great sort of Israeli DJ set, also live down the line over Zoom. Now we have VE Day, and there's a whole wealth of events that have been organized, albeit in the comfort of our own homes, that we should be observing them. Of course, there's going to be the 2-minute silence at 11 a.m. In the evening, of course, we have the speech from the Queen, and then there will be a sort of a national sing-along of Vera Lynn's famous song, We'll Meet Again, which I'm sure will bring a bit of a tear to our eyes because of obviously the situation that we're in, and it is very poignant. But, you know, the point is that we are celebrating, it is a celebration of 75 years since VE Day, the day when Winston Churchill finally declared the war was over, and the celebrations in the streets were just immense and amazing. And we have some incredible memories from Jewish care residents and volunteers who recall that exact moment when they were told that the war was over. So it's definitely worth a read in this week's Jewish News. Just have a look at those memories, because, you know, it's just a lovely thing. And although most of us can't recall the Second World War firsthand, to be able to still get those firsthand memories is amazing, and we should cherish that.
We certainly should. Okay. That's on page 26 of this week's Jewish News, and we will be hearing just one of those stories from Jewish care volunteer Morris Bennett, CBE, who joins us later in this very program. Just to finish off, there's also a story about communal fund, a new communal fund that's been set up to help those most in need.
That's right. A £3 million target on this particular pot of money that the JLC have a leading on with the support of a number of philanthropists. They're hoping to support social care causes across the community, whether it be mental health, domestic abuse, people receiving cancer treatment. And the idea really is backed up by an eye-watering number. They've done some research and discovered that among social care organisations that responded to this survey, there's a £5 million shortfall just since the beginning of COVID in what they would have expected to have raised. And so this fund really attempts to plug most of that. And let's wish them the best of luck.
Absolutely. And if you want to read more on that, you will find that on page 2 of the Jewish News for this week. Thank you both very much indeed. That is where we have to leave it for a look at the paper for this week. Thank you to Justin Cohen, news editor, and to features editor Fran Wolfish. Don't forget that you can pick up your copy of the Jewish News every Thursday. And if you are isolating at the moment, you'll find the full paper as it would be printed online at jewishnews.co.uk. Thank you both very much.
Thank you, Phil.
Thank you, Phil.
This is the JN Podcast. This week, YouTube deleted conspiracy theorist David Icke's account. Now, the video sharing site has said that the 68-year-old had violated its policies on sharing information about coronavirus. However, it comes after a joint letter from the CST, MP Damian Collins, and our next guest, presenter and campaigner Rachel Riley. They've all thrown their weight behind a bid to deplatform the former footballer. I'm delighted to say that Rachel joins me now. Rachel, first and foremost, thank you very much, not only for speaking to me, but frankly, for all of the tireless work that you do in terms of campaigning against misuse of social media, I think is the best way of putting it. But I can't help but thinking that maybe this week you're celebrating a bit of a victory.
Well, it's kind of not quite a victory yet. I mean, as you mentioned, YouTube have taken off David Icke's personal account from their platform, as have Facebook. They deleted him this week as well. So we're still calling on Twitter and Instagram to take action. And also, David Icke doesn't just work using his own profile. He uses a series of helpers where many people can view and still pay him money to spout his views. So we're calling for a complete deplatforming in terms of, you know, everything he says that's dangerous, that can cause harm to the public, to the NHS, to people, to protected groups. It shouldn't be allowed. He's violated policies across the board of social media. And it's been proven by Hope Not Haters, that was also another group who've backed this action. And they've shown that this has happened before. People have been deplatformed when they spout hate. And it works. If you conclusively take them off all of social media, then their message is drowned out. And if you just do it piecemeal, then unfortunately it gives them a boost. So social media companies set their rules and regulations for a reason, and we're calling on them to uphold those rules and regulations that they set for themselves.
Okay, but then there are going to be those in the absence of David Icke or anyone else who potentially backs his views. And we do have to state that we recognise that some people do think like that. But perhaps focusing more on you, why is it that this means so much to you personally? Why do you get so involved and so passionate about making sure that certain individuals are deplatformed?
Well, I was drawn into the world of online hate, accidentally becoming vocal against anti-Semitism, which I thought at the time would be just a, you know, generic, non-provocative, non-controversial topic. You know, we're all against racism and hatred, aren't we? That was my original view. And unfortunately, I was introduced to the world of hate and the world of online conspiracy a couple of years ago. And the CCDH and Centre for Countering Digital Hate are the best group I've met, at the forefront of learning how these groups operate, how hate actors work, how they manipulate systems, how they grow their followings, and, you know, investigating how, as a race, we can counter it. I think, you know, legislation and politicians are always slightly behind technology, and these hate actors are using these platforms to make a lot of money. And what they're doing is spreading these conspiracy theories. And when I was, you know, I first spoke out that I don't, you know, I think this particular incident was a bit racist, I was bombarded with theories about Rothschilds and even lizards. And I didn't have a clue where any of this came from, because none of it was rational. And when you start to look at, you know, the work that's already been done by Hope Not Hate, by CST, by the Centre for Countering Digital Hate, you see where it comes from, and you see how they spread, and you see how difficult it is. There's something called Brandolini's Law, which says that the order of magnitude to dispute, I won't use the word that's written, but dispute a load of rubbish, it's a more order of magnitude harder than it is to start it in the first place. So I realise it's really, really easy to start conspiracy theory. You don't need to understand what you're talking about. You don't need to know the context, the facts, anything like that. But to try and dissect it, to try and work out where on earth these stories have come from, and to try and disprove them when they're not built on rationale or logic in the first place, is really, really difficult. We've seen, you know, across the world, there's been the Christchurch massacre in New Zealand of Muslims praying. There's been attacks against Jews in America. Hate is growing. There've been attacks against Christians in Sri Lanka, and all sorts of incidents where the perpetrators are citing information that they're finding online. And whereas it used to be conspiracy theorists, you know, have a go and shout in the park with a tinfoil hat, and they're, you know, basically all their audience is a load of pigeons, now they're able to manipulate social media to access millions of people around the world, and they look more legitimate. They look like they're made by proper video productions, and people are buying this. So unfortunately, it's dangerous, and unfortunately, we need to wise up to it.
But isn't half of the problem, though, that this, I mean, there's twofold to this, really, because one, you could argue that whether we like it or not, it contradicts the term of free speech. Now, as much, again, as I repeat, we might not like what they say and don't necessarily condone it, but unfortunately, it does contradict free speech. But is it not also up to some degree, the individual who is reading this to determine what's genuine and what's not?
So what you've actually just said is factually incorrect. This isn't to do with free speech. Everyone has the right to free speech. In the UK, there are regulations about inciting hatred and that kind of thing. But this is an entirely different topic. This is about your right to a platform. Social media are, in effect, private companies. Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, all of these, and YouTube, they're private companies. You have the right to go out into the park and shout at pigeons and use your free speech however you choose, as long as you're not inciting hatred in the UK. But you don't have the right to a platform. These are private companies. If you tried to go into a nightclub and you were wearing trainers, that nightclub has the right to refuse you entry. Sacha Baron Cohen has made the argument that if a neo-Nazi goose steps into a restaurant, shouts at all its customers and does Sieg Heils, the restaurateur not only has the right to chuck them out, but the moral obligation to chuck them out because of the other customers and the effect that it can have. And social media companies are no different. I mean, let's not pretend that they're not making money from this. I mean, CCDH's report is 25 pages long, and it's estimated that that social media companies in total could be making up to $23.8 million from videos from David Icke. They've been viewed 30 million times. I mean, it's not a question of free speech. His free speech is not impinged in the slightest. And that's often a straw man argument that people use, that when they don't like what you're saying, you know, they'll tell me frequently, I don't like that you're shutting up free speech. You should shut up, which is, you know, ironic to the max. So we're not talking about free speech here. And in terms of crisis like the coronavirus, where we need a global reaction, a small number of people not adhering to the rules puts people in danger. 5G phone masts are being set alight. You know, we've seen other examples of fake news where people are drinking bleach, or they're being advised that their children, you know, don't need medication. They can have garlic rubbed on their feet. You know, that this kind of stuff is really affecting people in everyday life. And it's not just the people who buy into it, especially in the case of coronavirus. We can see that how all of our actions have an effect on each other. So we need to pay attention to it.
It's a really valid point. And in all the years that I have heard people talk about, and believe me, I've spoken about numerous anti-Semitic stories here and there and saying about the contradictory of free speech. What's really fascinating is no one has ever put it like that before in terms of the comparison to a restaurant, and also it's being a platform, it's not contradicting free speech. And I think there'll be an awful lot of people who would find that incredibly interesting. Just finally, because we're really up against it time-wise, but I have to ask you this. Based on, you mentioned earlier on, some of the backlash that you've come up against yourself personally, trying to combat some of this vitriol that's out there, have you ever thought to yourself that it's not worth the hassle? Because you do get a heck of a lot.
I mean, personally, being exposed to the hate and seeing how extreme people feel about it and how far they're willing to go to try and shut me up, to try and scare me, to try and intimidate me, that just shows me how big the problem is. So from my point of view, at the start of this, I realised that I was risking 10 years of, you know, being on telly, talking about maths and science and dog charities. And I was putting my credibility or my personality up against this, and I wanted to do that to say, you know, I hope that you know me, I hope that you know that I'm a nice normal person, and I don't think this is right. So it's been very difficult, but I've had a lot of support, and I know it's making a difference. And you know, as someone brought up learning about the Holocaust from a young age, and just learning that, you know, never again is should be something that we actually follow, not just words. And whether it's, you know, the Holocaust or any forms of hate, I think we need to stand up to it. We need to stand up to bullies. And that's been ingrained in me since I was really little. And thankfully, it's been ingrained in a lot of other people as well. And I'm not doing this by myself. There's a lot of support out there.
Well, thankfully, it is indeed your way to combat this because of being brought up in such a manner. So we say thank you very much indeed. And I say thank you very much indeed, Rachel Riley, for speaking to me on this episode of the JM Podcast. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
This is the JN Podcast. Now, this week marks 75 years since Victory in Europe Day. Ordinarily, such a milestone would be celebrated, perhaps with parties, exhibitions, special services. But of course, it's not possible that all of those will be happening as we may expect, for obvious reasons. Now, I'd hedge my bets that not everyone listening to this podcast will remember VE Day. But there are some who might, including our next guest. So let us mark this anniversary in the way that we know how, through social distancing. I'm honoured to say that joining me on the line is Morris Bennett, CBE. Morris is a Jewish care volunteer. He's a befriender, actually, to be more precise, who does normally face-to-face befriending, but is now doing it on the phone. And I'm delighted to say he's doing this on the phone as well. Morris, thank you so much for speaking to me on the JN Podcast. Take us back. Go all the way back to the events that built up to the 8th of May, 1945. Where were you? What was your life like then? And obviously tell us about the ramp up to what was to become VE Day.
Well, it was obviously an interesting time. I was 5.5 years old when the war began, 11 by the time it ended. There were many adventures that occurred in between. You know, we had air raids, gas masks, air raid bundles, the sirens, the Blitz, evacuation, a lot of things took place, but it was one of those things that you got used to. And I think that it is something that really has sort of helped me in later life, but coping with these difficult situations.
Well, I think that actually on that very subject, you know, there are those who compare what happened during the war to what is going on now with COVID-19. Now, to those who actually went through it, you are obviously best placed to tell us whether or not that is a ridiculous comparison or whether or not there is some truth to it. Do you see similarities between what life is like now in the disruption caused by coronavirus versus the disruption caused during the war?
Yes, I can definitely see a parallel. Obviously, when the war began, it started off quite slowly and then built up to a crescendo. So you had the opportunity over a very long period of time to attune yourself to the changing environment. The bombing didn't start on day one. It was 6 months or 8 months into the war before we were subjected to nightly bombing. And so you had a much longer period to adapt. Obviously, there are a lot of people around now who've never experienced that kind of difficulty. And the present crisis obviously came much more suddenly, and people have had less opportunity to adapt to it. But obviously, the big difference is that there was greater fear for our lives, and many more people were killed as a result of the Blitz than there ever will be as a result of the COVID crisis.
And I think that's what's quite difficult for people to get their heads around, is because so many are only going through this disruption as opposed to having gone through both disruptions. And please God, this is just the worst we ever have to tolerate. And no one's denying how awful it is, but hopefully it will be the worst that we have to endure.
I think that's a very fair assumption. You know, when we used to go to bed at night, one of the preparations we had to go through was to take our clothes, wrap them up inside our jackets, and it was called an air raid bundle. And you put all your clothes inside your jacket, did the buttons up, tied the sleeves, and then you had it ready when you had to rush downstairs to the shelter if you were lucky enough to have one, or just to get away from the most dangerous part of the house, which was obviously the upper floors. The COVID crisis, nothing like that at all. You don't actually go to bed in fear of your life. So as I said, I think the parallel obviously is people are scared, they are fearful, there are people who are dying. It's a very sad situation. But from the point of view of sort of exactly comparing it to a world war where, you know, you're suffering from the bombing and fear of invasion and all the other problems that occurred at the time, the rationing and everything else, this is a bit of a doddle by comparison.
Well, thank you for at least clarifying that, and hopefully people will take note of that and take heed from it as well. Let's focus more on the 8th of May 1945, because yeah. What was that moment like when Churchill did declare victory in Europe?
Well, it was a little bit of an anticlimax, in so much as I do remember it very well because I was at school, and on May the 8th itself, they gave us a holiday, which was much appreciated. I think, in fact, we had 2 days holiday, but certainly one day I remember well as I went to the cinema in the afternoon. I think people were so tired, so weary of nearly 6 years of war, but there was excitement, and obviously people were relieved. But as I said, it wasn't the end of World War II. It was just the end of the war in Europe. And the real celebrations, victory parades and everything, didn't take place till the following year, in 1946, in June. They really sort of rolled out the red carpet, and people really celebrated, and they had troops from all over the world, allies, all joined in the march and everything. So for me, the actual day, D-Day, because Hitler had committed suicide more than a week before, Admiral Dönitz had been appointed Chancellor of Germany, and everybody knew that it was coming to an end. It was just a question of waiting sort of day by day. So yes, of course, it was a magic moment, but as I said, I don't remember specifically great excitement, people dancing in the streets. I think I remember more excitement when the war did finally end in September with the surrender of Japan. Then I think people thought, ah, it's all over. But on VE Day itself, I spent a fairly quiet day. As I said, we had the day off from school. I went to the cinema, I saw a film with Marlene Dietrich in it. I think it was called Hotel Berlin. And
fabulous.
As I said, I think you mentioned that there were a lot of people that didn't have particular memories, and I think the reason is it wasn't that memorable a day. It was, you know, the events leading up to it were fairly predictable.
Well, Morris, I have to tell you, I could happily speak to you all day about this because I love hearing about it. I think it's fascinating. I think there is so much to learn from individuals such as yourself who actually went through true hardship and really did see some of the most ghastly times in our history. But unfortunately, we are out of time. I am pleased to say, though, that if you want to hear even more VE Day stories from residents and members of community centres, as well as the whole community, they are available on the Jewish Care website. That's jcare.org. In the meantime, though, I have to say a huge thank you to Morris Bennett, CBE. Thank you so much for speaking to us on this episode of the JN podcast.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This is the JN podcast. During these times of COVID-19, we are planning here on the JN podcast to speak to as many coronavirus heroes as we possibly can. Just to remind ourselves that no matter how unnerving this moment in our history may be, there are those who are doing something positive with it. Now, that certainly applies to our next guest. And I have to tell you, we'd be hard pressed to find anyone more impressive, even if this is only episode 2. Alex Kortz is 11 years old, and he has been creating dozens of visors to help healthcare workers. Now, I don't want you to get the wrong impression here. This is no sticky back plastic and old loo rolls involved. Alex has been creating them with his 3D printer, which he got for his birthday in October last year. Let's speak to him now. Alex, first and foremost, well done. Clearly, you're a very considerate sort of chap, and I sense that most 11-year-olds probably wouldn't think of doing what you've done. So where did you get the idea from?
Well, I made it myself, so I like normally help in the community. So I saw my teacher doing it from school, and then I thought of the idea of me also helping.
So your teacher made a visor for healthcare workers, and that's where you got the idea from, yes?
Yeah.
Excellent. Okay, so what was this? It's during like one of your classes?
It was on one of the newsletters.
Ah, I see. Okay. Now, there are going to be some of us out there who don't know what a 3D printer actually is. Now, I recognise that the clue should be in the title, but maybe just in case, can you explain what a 3D printer does?
It makes objects 3D.
It does make them 3D, and in particular what it does, doesn't it, is it actually takes information from a computer. So in exactly the same way with a 2D printer, a traditional printer, we type up a letter and then we go to print it. You can create an object on the computer and then print it three-dimensional using a 3D printer. Is that right?
Yes.
So very, very clever stuff. I don't necessarily want you to give away trade secrets, but how did you make the visor? Did you have to learn a special program or anything? Or did you just say, right, computer, this is what I want to do? How did that work?
My teacher sent me the link of a website where I got it from.
Ah, okay. And so with your 3D printer, you requested that for your birthday. That's quite an unusual birthday present, isn't it?
Yeah.
But do you use it a lot, or was this one of the first times you've used it?
I use it a lot. I make my friends' birthday presents. I make key rings, I make phone covers, I make movable animals.
Wow. And you do all of this from your computer, so you program it yourself?
Yeah.
That's fantastic. Is there any chance that this is something that you want to do potentially later in life, that you maybe want to go into 3D printing as a potential job?
Yeah.
Do you know what you might make with it?
I may start making stuff for doctors to put with hearts and stuff.
Fantastic. Well, when you make the visors for the healthcare workers, how do we get it to them? Because obviously a lot of healthcare workers have to remain isolated from everyone else in society for obvious reasons. So how do you actually get them to those healthcare workers?
So once the print's finished, I have to use gloves to put it into a plastic bag.
Very good.
And then once they're in the plastic bag, I have to write my name on it, the date, and leave it in there for 3 days.
I see. So you actually have to leave it, so there's no chance of any virus being left behind if you happen to be carrying it. Is that right?
Yeah, and then I take it to Queen Elizabeth's boys' school.
Well, well done, you. How many visors have you made so far, do you know?
About 40.
40? Good gracious, that's fantastic. Well done. So how many more do you think you're going to make?
I don't know.
You're going to keep going until you're told otherwise, hopefully. Now, I understand that it's not just you in your family who is doing their bit for charity. Am I right in thinking that also your older sister, is it Chloe, has also been doing stuff for charity?
Yes.
Do you know what she's been doing? Can you tell us about that?
She's been baking cakes, and then we've also been giving them.
Now, Alex, be honest with me. Have you eaten any of the cakes?
Yes.
Very good. Why not indeed? I think you've well and truly earned them. So what is next then for you? Hopefully you carry on making visors, but do you know if you're going to look, you've already said actually, you're going to potentially look at doing some other medical equipment as well. Is that the top of your list, or have you got any other plans up your sleeve?
I've also done some other stuff already for the NHS. I've made, with the normal masks, a rester that doesn't make, when the doctors are wearing the masks, feel uncomfortable.
Absolutely amazing.
So the bit that goes around the ear, the 3D printed thing, goes at the back of their head and attaches on.
Well, frankly, I don't know you, Alex. I haven't met you before. I even haven't spoken to you before today, but I think you're absolutely brilliant. So thank you very much indeed, not just for talking to us on the JM podcast this week, but also for everything you're doing in your effort to try and help fight COVID-19, because I think it's remarkable. So well done.
Thank you.
There we go. How fantastic was that? Thank you very much indeed to Alex Courts there, telling us about the impressive work that he's doing in a bid to try and combat COVID-19 by making visors for healthcare workers. This is the JN podcast. Now, each week here on the show, we are going to get the thoughts of an industry expert. We are certainly seeing some very strange times at the moment, not only in our everyday lives, but economically speaking as well. So we'll get the thoughts of someone in the know. Today we hear from Mark Knorr, Group CEO of Miramar Agencies, a collective of marketing and advertising agencies.
In the last few months, real damage has been done to the economy and to people's lives. Levels of anxiety have risen as many fear for their families, their livelihoods, and the wider community, compounded by the stress of lockdown and the dominance of bad news in the media. Clearly, it's had a massive impact on our community. But this is not solely a Jewish community problem, so we need to avoid taking a parochial view. Spend across all sectors of business have fallen through the floor, resulting in furloughing, layoffs, and cost reductions as revenues are hit hard. And it's likely that we'll see many businesses fail this year. Some commentators believe that it'll take till the end of next year for the economy to fully recover. For all the talk of how the coronavirus is a leveller, all the way up to princes and prime ministers, the impact of the virus has been asymmetric, hitting different people, businesses and charities differently. I've spent my time thinking through how all the organisations I'm connected with, commercial and charitable, can best survive this. And though each is different, here are three guiding principles. One, the preservation of cash, without which neither businesses nor charities can survive. Secondly, deferring to core purpose, objectives and values, which if set correctly should be enduring. That includes our commitment to treating people with dignity, recognizing that they may be colleagues, suppliers or clients, but they're human beings first. And thirdly, inventiveness. This is a time to rethink, innovate and acquire. Be that new skills, new perspectives, or new partners. And as with every crisis in history, this period will demonstrate the survival of the flexible. Speaking of which, when it comes to work, things really needed to change. And we've all just been shown how in a forced mass experiment of home and flexible working. As individuals, we've also been reminded about the existence and indeed the benefit of our communities, asking, how are you? And genuinely interested in the answer and looking to help in any way we can. We've engaged more deeply with family and with nature. We've listened to the voice of science over social media. And we've seen businesses pivot to play their part. Brands like Burberry and McLaren turning their hands to making PPE and ventilators. Brands like Leon and Pret catering for frontline workers. And it's not just commercial businesses that have successfully adapted in response to the crisis. As chairman of JW3, a key communal charity, I'm incredibly proud of how swiftly and successfully the team of professionals and volunteers have pivoted. We've transformed ourselves into a virtual Jewish community centre, launching JW3 TV as a platform to share hundreds of hours of free content to engage and entertain people stuck at home. And we've swiftly trained up all of our Hebrew teachers and adult education lecturers to teach our full range of classes and courses via Zoom. So too our Gateways program for some of the most vulnerable young people in our community, all now operating online. And it's not just the Jewish community that we need to focus on at this time. In order to help wider society, we've set up a temporary food bank at JW3, where volunteers are now working each week to provide over 3,500 meals worth of donated food to people living in food poverty. This is not an easy time to be running a commercial or a charitable organization. But I'm an optimist by nature, and the entrepreneur in me knows crises force significant change, and change can also be positive. We will come out of this. The pendulum will swing back.
Mark Knorr, Group CEO of Miramar Agencies, a collective of marketing and advertising agencies. Thank you very much to him. Well, there you go. That's it for this episode of the JM Podcast. At this stage, I'd like to say thank you to all of our guests on this show. Rachel Riley, Morris Bennett, CBE, Alex Kortz, Mark Knorr, our paper team, Justin Cohen and Fran Wolfish. And we must also say thank you to Justin Cohen as he's produced this show as well. I also say thank you to you for listening. Please do subscribe to the show in your podcast application. That way you'll be able to hear any previous episode and be informed of when new ones are released. If you'd like to comment, then it's editorial@thejngroup.com. That's editorial@thejngroup.com. Also, if you'd like any more information on any of the stories we've covered, then simply head to jewishnews.co.uk. From me, Phil Dave, do join us next time here on the JN Podcast. Goodbye.